In Holden Village. Today in the Creekside Room, the speaker is Sarah Forth. The title is Responses to Evil in Margaret Atwood. So let's listen in on Sarah Forth.
A couple things. It's obvious I use literature, contemporary literature, to reflect on theological issues. I'm not going to say too much about the theory of religion and literature, religion and theology. I prefer to do the practice, and we'll get to practice it here in this session. But if you're a pastor or teacher and you're particularly interested in it, or we can have a conversation, you know, coffee time or a meal or something, if you want to think more about the issues involved. I'm also not going to talk a whole lot about evil in the abstract. I use as my operating definition of evil Rosemary Ruther's definition, which is distorted relationality that damages both sides of the relationship. That covers a lot of territory, but it's a useful working definition, distorted relationality. So that doesn't give us a list of things that are evil or acts that are evil, but it requires us to look at what's actually going on in the relationships between people, whether that's individually or within the larger society. So I'm going to plunge right in with Margaret Atwood and read a quote from her in which she said, "If you define yourself as innocent, then nothing is ever your fault. It is always someone else doing it to you, and until you stop defining yourself as a victim, that will always be true. It will always be somebody else's fault, and you will always be the object of that rather than somebody who has any choice or takes responsibility for their life. And that is not only the usual Canadian stance towards the world, but the usual female one. If you define yourself as innocent, then nothing is ever your fault."
Well, interesting.
Where's that from?
From an interview, or possibly, actually, this may be from one of her book essays.
Can you read it one more time, please?
Sure. "If you define yourself as innocent, then nothing is ever your fault. It is always somebody else doing it to you. And until you stop defining yourself as a victim, that will always be true." Now, those of you who have read other books by Atwood know that she deals a lot with people who either see themselves as victims or have been placed in a victim position by society. And a bodily harm takes up that issue of being a victim and complicates it by focusing on a woman who is both a victim but also a perpetrator of evil. And it's going to allow us to talk about how it is as privileged people in the first world, we can be both victims of systemic evil and also help perpetuate it.
I forgot to mention I have read Bodily Harm.
Oh, you've read Bodily Harm. Okay. I think there are about three of us in North America who have read. I have to say, although this shouldn't be my preface to this class, that I didn't ask the bookstore to order copies of this because people universally hate this book. It's very hard to take. You didn't hate it? Okay, good. That's interesting. Well, we'll talk about that.
Although, I guess I can remember some broad things. I can't remember details, so it's going to be useful.
Okay. In particular, in this book, Atwood is dealing with how innocence, false innocence, removing oneself from suffering, stands in the way of real compassion. So I'll explain more about that as we go. What I thought I would do is say a little bit about the book. Now, we haven't come here having read it, so what I usually do is give a synopsis of the narrative flow of the book, say a little something about its structure and what I think she's doing, and then I brought along a couple of excerpts that I think will give us a pretty good crystallization of the issues in the book. And we'll read those together and then work on the issues that it brings up. So let me just give you a little bit about what this novel's about. First of all, Bodily Harm is set up sort of as a mystery story in an exotic locale. Hence, the publishers put on this very romantic cover. That's not really what's going on, but that's the surface of the novel. She uses the mystery genre, and you're always asking a lot of questions about what's really going on here. So she plays with the reader's expectations a lot. The main character's name, Renata Wilford, called Rennie for short. She's from Toronto, and she's a lifestyle writer. She goes around writing about trends and style and fashion. She's attempting to escape the aftermath of surgery for breast cancer, which is part of the title Bodily Harm. She feels physically violated by this illness. And also the end of a relationship she's just had with a man named Jake. She takes an assignment to do a travel piece on a Caribbean island named San Antoine. But even before she gets onto the island, on the plane there, she meets a Dr. Minow, who is a political rival to the country's dictator. Dr. Minow hopes to interest this journalist in exposing the corruption of the dictator and letting the world know about his people's poverty. So she arrives on this island determined to stay away from politics and interested just in the exotic locale, but already she's getting pressured to look around her and to see what's really going on, which she resists strongly. She's very caught up with the pain that she's feeling over this relationship and with her recent surgery. Well, what follows is that she attracts a lot of attention on the island from the local Marxists, the gun runners, the drug dealers, and the CIA agents, although you can't really tell who's who in this novel, and it's never quite clear to either the reader or to Rennie who's playing what kind of role. And she just willy-nilly gets caught up in this. Not only that, but Dr. Minow keeps coming after her, trying to educate her about what's going on in this island. He keeps calling her one of the sweet Canadians who are innocently naive about the real politics and the brutal poverty that his people exist in. And then there's a fellow Canadian, a sort of hanger-on named Laura, who is the sometimes lover of the Marxist leader, who gets Rennie involved in a trip to the airport to pick up a box that's supposedly medicine, although it's really clear that Rennie is being very naive about getting involved in this escapade, but she does it anyway because she was brought up to be a good girl and do nice things for people. Almost without thinking about it, Rennie falls into bed with this sexy, danger-loving, dope and gun-smuggling fellow named Paul, who seems to be the first man to treat Rennie squarely, if the truth be told. And if the novel ended with their affair, we might have proof that orgasms really are a cure for cancer. It's quite a love affair, but real life intervenes. And in the midst of this love affair, the elections take place, and Dr. Minow wins the elections, and he forms a coalition with the Marxists to lead the government. But as things often turn out, Dr. Minow's assassinated, and the dissidents attempt a takeover, which is ruthlessly crushed by the dictator. And Rennie, because of her involvement with all of these folks, ends up in jail with Laura. And the last 40 pages of the novel are their life together in this prison cell and the brutality of that. I won't tell you what happens at the end. I'll leave that for later in our discussion. So you have this sort of mystery adventure novel going on the surface. It's sort of like a Clue game. Anyone ever grow up playing that game called Clue, where you had to figure out who did it with what weapon in where it was? Right. Well, Margaret Atwood sets up that motif very early in the book, because before Rennie leaves home, in fact, one of the reasons that propels her to take this trip is that she arrives home one day to find the police in her apartment because a man has entered and left, leaving nothing but a rope coiled on the bed. And this is what Rennie's mind. All I could think of was a game we used to play. You had to guess three things. Mr. Green in the conservatory with a pipe wrench, Miss Plum in the kitchen with a knife. Only I couldn't remember whether the name in the envelope was supposed to be the murderers or the victims. Miss Wilford in the bedroom with a rope. And it's this confusion about whether one is a victim or the perpetrator that carries through the entire novel. Because she's both. She's been a victim of men. She's been a victim of the cultural objectification of women. At the same time, she goes to the small island and discovers how she's complicit in the political economy that keeps a lot of people in brutal poverty. Why don't we go right to the reading, because I think that'll get us into the heart of the novel. What I prefer to do is have one person read, and we pass the job around, you know, read a paragraph and then pass it on and read another paragraph, because listening is different than reading silently to ourselves, and it becomes much more of a communal event. So, it's okay, pull up the chair. We're just about to read an excerpt from the novel Bodily Harm. So there are two short excerpts which give you a sense of how of Rennie's background, what she grew up with, a very provincial morality. And then there's a longer sequence, which is her conversation with Dr. Minow, and we get to eavesdrop on how she tries to avoid taking responsibility for what she sees around her. What I'd like us to do is start by reading a paragraph or however much you feel comfortable, and then when you're finished, turn it over to the next person and they can continue reading until we get to the conversation with Dr. Minow. And then what I thought we'd do with that is actually set it up with a man's voice and a woman's voice having the actual conversation. So this is about Rennie Wilford's background. Bill, would you mind starting that?
Rennie is from Griswold, Ontario. Griswold is what they call her background, though it's less like a background. A backdrop, picturesque red Victorian houses and autumn trees on a hillside in the distance. Then a subground, something that can't be seen but is nevertheless there, full of gritty old rocks and buried stumps, worms and bones. Nothing you'd want to go into. Those who lately been clamoring for roots have never seen a root up close, Rennie used to say. She had, and she'd rather be some other part of the plant. In an earlier phase, Rennie used to tell jokes about Griswold to abuse her friends, such as, how many people from Griswold does it take to change a light bulb? The whole town. One to change it, and a snoop. And the rest of them to discuss how sinful you are for wanting more light. Or, how many people from Griswold does it take to change a light bulb? None. If the light goes out, it's the will of God, and who are you to complain? People from bigger places, Jake in particular, think that Griswold has an exotic and primitive charm. Rennie doesn't think this. Mostly she tries to avoid thinking about Griswold at all. Griswold, she hopes, is merely something she defines herself against.
I grew up surrounded by old people. My grandfather and my grandmother and my great aunts and great uncles who came to visit after church. I thought of my mother as old too. She wasn't, but being around them all the time made her feel. On the street she walked slowly so they could keep up with her. She raised her voice the way they did. She was anxious about details. She wore clothes like theirs too, dark dresses with high collars and small innocuous patterns, dots, or sprigs of flowers.
As a child, I learned three things well: how to be quiet, what not to say, and how to look at things without touching them. When I think of that house, I think of objects and silences. The silences were almost visible. I pictured them as gray, hanging in the air like smoke. I learned to listen for what wasn't being said, because it was usually more important than what was. My grandmother was the best at silences. According to her, it was bad manners to ask direct questions.
The objects in the house were another form of silence. Clocks, vases, end tables, cabinets, figurines, crude sets, cranberry glass, china plates. They were considered important because they once belonged to someone else. They were both overpowering and frail. Overpowering because threatening. What they threatened you with was their frailty. They were always on the verge of breaking. These objects had to be cleaned and polished once a week by my grandmother when she was still well enough, and afterward by my mother. It was understood that you could never sell these objects or give them away. The only way you could ever get rid of them was to will them to somebody else and then die. I know the feeling well.
Yes. The objects weren't beautiful, most of them. They weren't supposed to be. They were only supposed to be of the right kind. The standard aimed at was not beauty, but decency. That was the word, too, among my mother and my aunts when they came to visit. Are you decent? They would call gaily to one another before opening bedroom or bathroom doors. Decency was having your clothes on in every way possible.
If you were a girl, it was a lot safer to be decent than to be beautiful. If you were a boy, the question didn't arise. The choice was whether or not you were a fool. Clothes could be decent or indecent. Mine were always decent, and they smelled decent too. A wool smell, mothballs, and a hint of furniture polish. Other girls from families considered shoddy and loose wore questionable clothes and smelled like violets.
The opposite of decent wasn't beautiful, but flashy or cheap. Flashy, cheap people drank and smoked. And who knew what else? Everyone knew in Griswold, everyone knew everything sooner or later.
Read just to your mark.
Yes.
So you had your choice. You could decide whether people would respect you or not. It was harder if your family wasn't respectable, but it could be done. If your family was respectable, though, you could choose not to disgrace it. The best way to keep from disgracing it was to do nothing unusual.
Thank you. Well, Algie, you said you found something familiar in this.
Well, just the idea of the saving of family relics, you know,
right.
and although they you know had no intrinsic value. I mean, you say this was my great grandmother's. You know, this is a nice point, but and you can't do anything with them
except will them.
Except to will them to somebody else. My daughter won't have the same problem. Because that's precisely what I will do.
What else did you hear her talking about the kind of morality that she was taught growing up, about being decent?
It all sounded terribly familiar. Yeah.
Not doing anything different.
Mm-hmm.
Don't make waves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Image.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they still gossiped, and that wasn't considered indecent.
Right. And everyone always would end up knowing everything in Griswold.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's probably true of any small town, you know, where everyone is familiar with everyone else.
And you're not to want more light. It's the will of God to sit here in the darkness.
Yeah, that's...
Okay. Well, that kind of heritage...
That's the innocence thing, too.
That's right.
It's the what?
Right. Bear to the innocence thing, Bill said. Bear to stay in the dark, then see what's really going on. Well, what that... means is that Rennie grows up studiously trying to involve herself in what's going on, trying to avoid massive involvement, as she puts it.
when she goes to see her doctor and discovers she has breast cancer, he says, oh, well, don't worry, you probably won't do a complete mastectomy unless there's massive involvement, which is a euphemism for spreading of the cancer. And she says to him, oh, massive involvement, it's never been my thing. So this next conversation is between Dr. Minow, who is a man passionately committed to his people, trying to wake Rennie up. Now, what I thought I would do is that I would play the narrator of this piece, and if we could get a man and a woman to play Dr. Minow and Rennie, I realize not having read it, it may read a little rough at first, but let's try it and see if we can get it going. Gary, would you play Dr. Minow?
Sure.
Okay. Sarah, how would you feel about reading Rennie? Do you mind being the studiously innocent? Okay, what I will do
is... You're also a narrator?
I'll be the narrator, read everything that's not in quotation marks. And if necessary, I can give you your cue there. But I think we'll be able to hear this a little bit better if we hear it like this. Okay, they're on the island. Dr. Minow has just taken Rennie to see the historic prison, which is the one tourist site on this desolate island. But she's also seen hurricane victims who are camped out there in these very shoddy refugee camps. This hurricane had come through the island some months, maybe even years before, and the foreign aid that had been sent to the island on their behalf has disappeared somewhere. So these people are still living in the shanty town out of this fort. So it reads, Dr. Minow has insisted on taking her to lunch, and Rennie, hungry enough to eat an arm, has not protested. They're in a Chinese restaurant, which is small, dark, and hotter than the outside sunlight. Two ceiling fans stir the damp air but do not cool it. Rennie feels sweat already wetting her underarms and trickling down her chest. The table is red formica, spotted with purplish-brown sauce. Dr. Minow smiles across at her, kindly, avuncular, his bottom teeth clasped over the top ones like folded hands.
There is always a Chinese restaurant, he says, everywhere in the world. They're indefatigable. They're like the Scots. You kick them out in one place, and they turn up in another. I myself am part Scottish. I've often considered going to the Gathering of the Clans. My wife says this is what makes me so pig-headed.
Rennie is somewhat relieved to hear that he has a wife. He's been too attentive. There must be a catch. A waiter comes and Rennie lets Dr. Minow order for her.
Sometimes I think I should have remained in Canada, he says. I could live in an apartment or a split-level bungalow like the sweet Canadians and be a doctor of sheep. I even enjoy the snow. The first time it snowed, I ran out into it in my socks without a coat. I danced. It made me so happy. But instead, I come back here.
The green tea arrives and Rennie pours it. Dr. Minow takes his cup, turns it, and sighs.
The love of your own country is a terrible curse, my friend, especially a country like this one. It's much easier to live in someone else's country. Then you're not tempted.
Tempted? Says Rennie.
To change things.
Rennie feels they're heading straight towards a conversation she doesn't really want to have. She tries to think of another topic. At home, there's always the weather, but that won't do here since there is no weather. Dr. Minow leans across the table towards her.
I will be honest with you, my friend, he says. There's something I wish you to do.
Rennie isn't surprised. Here it comes, whatever it is.
What's that?
Allow me to explain. This is our first election since the departure of the British. Perhaps it will be the last, since it's my own belief that the British parliamentary system will no longer work in this place. It works in Britain only because they have a tradition. There are still things that are inconceivable. Here, nothing is inconceivable.
He pauses, sips at his tea.
I wish you to write about it.
whatever Rennie's been expecting, it isn't this. But why not? People are always coming to her about their favorite hot topic. She feels her eyes glaze over. Great, she should say. Good idea. Then they're satisfied. Instead, she says,
what on earth could I write about it?
What you see, says Doctor.
Says Dr. Mound, choosing not to pick up on her exasperation.
All I ask you to do is look. We will call you an observer, like our friends at the United Nations.
He gives a small laugh.
Look with your eyes open and you will see the truth of the matter. Since you're a reporter, it's your duty to report.
Rennie reacts badly to the word duty. Duty was big in Griswold.
I'm not that kind of reporter.
I understand, my friend. You are a travel writer. It's an accident you're here. But you are all we can turn to at the moment. There's no one else. If you were a political journalist, the government would not have been happy to see you. They would have delayed your entry or expelled you. In any case, we are too small to attract the attention of anyone from the outside. And by the time they're interested, it'll be too late for the blood.
Blood? Oops, sorry.
Blood?
News.
The waiter brings a platter of tiny corn cobs and some things that look like steamed erasers, and another of greens and squid. Rennie picks up her chopsticks. A minute ago, she was hungry.
We have 75% unemployment. 60% of our population is under 20. Trouble happens when the people have nothing left to lose. Ellis knows this. He's using the foreign aid money from the hurricane to bribe the people. The hurricane was an act of God, and Ellis thinks that too. He holds out his hands to heaven and prays for someone up there to save his ass for him, and bang, all that money from the sweet Canadians? This is not all. He's using threats now. He says he will take away the jobs and maybe burn down the houses of those who do not vote for him.
He's doing this openly?
On the radio, my friend. As for the people, many are afraid of him, and the rest admire him, not for this behavior, you understand, but because he can get away with it. They see this as power, and they admire a big man here. He spends their money on new cars and so forth for himself and his friends, and they applaud that. They look at me, they say, what can you do for us? If you have nothing, you are nothing here. It's the old story, my friend. We will have Papa Doc, and after that a revolution or so, and then the Americans will wonder why people are getting killed, and they should tell the sweet Canadians to stop giving money to this man.
Rennie knows she's supposed to feel outrage. She remembers the early 70s. She remembers all that outrage you were supposed to feel. Not to feel it then was very unfashionable. At the moment, though, all she feels is imposed upon. Outrage is out of date.
What good would it do, even if I wrote it? I couldn't get it published here. I don't know anyone.
Dr. Minow laughs.
Not here. Here there is one paper only, and Ellis has bought the editor. In any case, few can read. No, you should publish it there. This will be of help. They pay attention to the outside. They're sensitive about foreign aid. They would know they are being watched, that someone knows what they're doing. This would stop the excesses.
Rennie wonders what an excess is.
I'm sorry, but I can't think of anyone who would touch it. It isn't even a story yet. Nothing's happened. It's hardly of general interest.
There is no longer any place that's not of general interest. The sweet Canadians have not learned that yet. The Cubans are building a large airport in Grenada. The CIA is here. They wish to nip history in the bud, and the Russian agents. It's of general interest to them.
Rennie almost laughs. The CIA has been done to death. Surely by now it's a joke. He can't be serious.
I suppose they're after your natural resources.
Dr. Minow stares across at Rennie, smiling his cramped smile, no longer entirely kindly and friendly.
As you know, we have lots of sand and not much more, but look at a map, my friend.
He's no longer pleading, he's lecturing.
South of St. Antoine is St. Agatha. South of St. Agatha is Grenada. South of Grenada is Venezuela with oil, a third of U.S. imports. North of us here, there is Cuba. We are a gap in the chain. Whoever controls us controls the transport of oil to the United States. The boats go from Guyana to Cuba with rice, from Cuba to Grenada with guns. Nobody is playing.
Renny puts down her chopsticks. It's too hot to eat. She feels as if she's stumbled into something. Don't allow this conversation to go on too long. A minute more and she'll be hooked.
It's not my thing. I just don't do that kind of thing. I do lifestyles.
Lifestyles?
Dr. Minow's puzzled.
You know, what people wear, what they eat, where they go for vacations, what they've got in their living rooms, things like that.
Says Renny as lightly as she can. Dr. Minow considers this for a moment. Then he gives her an angelic smile.
You might say that I'm also concerned with lifestyles. It's our duty to be concerned with lifestyles. What the people eat, what they wear. This is what I want you to write about.
He's got her.
Well, I'll think about it.
She says limply.
Good.
Says Dr. Minow, beaming.
It's all I wish.
Thank you very much. You're welcome to keep this if you'd like. And I'll pass around copies for other folks. Well, what did you hear in that conversation, or what does it bring to mind?
She's doing everything she can to avoid what's right in front of her.
Right. What's right in front of her?
She sees it when she's there, and she's told about it. And she's at a restaurant where they're feeding her. And she's not even paying for it.
Good point. Yeah. What would you do in her place?
Well, I would write about it and save the world. Good question.
Of course. Right answer. Pass. Class dismissed.
In an active, non-violent way.
You've been going to Rosie's class. Yeah,
great. Sir, it's paid to take care of people.
That's right.
Well, has anyone been in a similar situation where you feel as if you've been confronted? Maybe by not a Dr. Minow, but something's been there.
Well, to a certain extent, we're all in that situation. I mean, we're enjoying our food while there are people out on the streets that don't have any.
Yeah.
And we're just not choosing not to think about it.
Uh-huh. Is L.A. the only city where there are panhandlers on every corner?
No.
So that's something that you see every day, people asking you to house them, feed them.
Holding up signs saying, no work for food.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Although I saw one once that said, I want
a four-door Dodge Dart. So... I didn't want Volvo. So
funny.
Are we being like Renny?
I think it's overwhelming. Is what part of the problem is? Is that
yeah,
most people I do think want to help, but even when you see people on the street wanting food or I will work for food, we have our doubts whether they really would work for food. We
right.
have our doubts. If they're going to buy food or are you going to buy alcohol?
Uh-huh.
And so there's a huge black cloud that just comes and we don't know how to solve the problem. Yeah, we'd like this person to eat and have shelter, but we're not sure how to go about doing
right.
that. Because we can't do it as an individual, we need to do it as a community.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So it feels overwhelming. Yeah. You said something about we don't know how to solve the problem, and I wondered if that may be one of the roadblocks to how we respond to people. Because what would solving the problem be? The guys ask you for money.
Well, that's my assumption is the problem is that they need food and shelter.
Uh-huh.
And giving money, I don't believe, is solving that. So
right.
I guess the next step would be maybe giving money to the Salvation Army so that there would be more food and shelter available.
Huh. So that might be another option. But I think those are the kinds of very problematic issues that come up when we try to address what are these huge systemic patterns of social evil. And that's really what I wanted to focus on today. Rennie grew up with this very provincial idea of morality being decent in some way, which doesn't really prepare us, those of us who have also grown up with that kind of morality, to know how to respond to patterns that transcend our immediate situation and history, situations we've acquired. I never personally owned slaves, but I've acquired racism as part of my the privilege of being a white person in this country, in this century. I know that I benefit, that I can make assumptions about what my life is going to be about that people with a dark skin or a Spanish accent can't assume. I can walk down the streets of Los Angeles and no Immigration and Naturalization Service agent is going to pull me over and ask for my green card. And it happens to Latinos and Latinas all the time. In fact, I heard of a guy who, when he was asked for his green card, pulled out his American Express card. You know, I'm an American citizen is what he was saying, and I have economic rights here. So that's the kind of privilege that we grew up in. And then the question about how we address that is partly a question of definition, which is why I ask you about solving.
Something here, I can't find it. The point is made where the Canadians sent money down to these people
right.
to help them out with the hurricane relief, and that money never got to them,
right.
which leaves the people who want to do something to help pretty helpless
mm-hmm.
themselves if they can't. Everybody running down wherever it is to say, here's my dollar.
Uh-huh.
But if it never gets there,
yeah.
What can you do?
And Atwood sets up a pretty pessimistic picture of trying to give help. Unfortunately, it is a lot. It's true.
Mm-hmm.
It's true.
It's
yeah.
Basically very true.
Yeah.
This really rang bells for me. And I can't remember if when I read the book, what year did it come to? Okay.
Thank you.
So I'm wondering, because the memory it brought up to me is being in a Chinese restaurant in San Salvador on an educational trip to El Salvador for like the 8. And, you know, just even the business of that Chinese restaurant food in every place.
Oh, right.
Uh-huh. And I think mm-hmm. the overwhelming feeling when, and that was, you know, an Augsburg College Center for Global Education trip, the specific purpose of which is to try to make connections for us on what we can do. And I think the biggest reaction to one of those trips is it is so totally frustrating on how limited. I mean, you do get some handles on it, but they are big systemic handles. And but then they do go into your life too, like what coffee do you buy and what, you know.
So there are small individual choices.
Yeah, there's both. It's the letters to the representatives about what our policy is doing, and then there's also what are the little tentacles of whatever our lifestyle is into what's happening there. But it is the whole purpose of those tools is to kind of struggle with this because it is so hard.
Uh-huh. There's an ethicist named Sharon Welsh who talks about an ethic of control versus an ethic in risk, and how this relates is that when we start talking about defining what would be a solution, often we try to define the end point, the solution. But that often leads to an ethic of control where you try to control the outcomes, and you never can with a human systems. There are too many variables sent into this. And she recommends what she calls an ethic of risk, where you work together in community, doing as best you can, and you can't foresee the outcome. That often middle class people get very discouraged because it looks like we're not solving the problem. And that, in fact, all we can do is what lies within our power to do.
And struggle with the problems. I know that that when we were trying to struggle coming back from since El Salvador and Nicaragua at that point, when we talked with people who are more knowledgeable, they would always talk about community, that the important thing was community. To get into community and then start the process of struggling with what. But the community was all important.
One of the pieces that Margaret Atwood is also also brings to our attention is this discussion about victim and how we define ourselves as victims and whether we'll accept that definition. She wrote a book about Canadian literature where she sort of suggested that a great theme in Canadian literature is Canadians as victims of one thing, of the weather or of being too far north or economic victims. But it's her overall model of, she says there are four stages of victims. The first stage position is to deny the fact that you are a victim, which uses up a lot of energy because you spend a lot of time explaining away the obvious and suppressing anger and pretending that certain visible facts do not exist. And this is Rennie's position because it's favored by people who have a few privileges and don't want to challenge to lose those privileges by challenging the status quo. So you deny that you are any kind of victim. It's clear throughout the novel that Rennie's allowed herself to be victimized by men who use and abuse her in relationships that are far from healthy. And it's not until her mastectomy that she's able to, that she has to take a step back and come, starts to awaken to the fact that maybe this hasn't been so good for her. So the second stage victim position is to acknowledge the fact that you're a victim, but to explain this as an act of fate, the will of God, the dictates of biology, necessity decreed by history or economics or the unconscious, or any other large, general, powerful idea. And the advantage to this is then it's some great power that you can't possibly affect in any way, so you're excused from changing it. If in the first stage you didn't think there needed to be any change, in the second stage you can go around saying, well, I can't really do anything about this, so I don't need to try. Laura, who ends up in prison with Rennie, is one of those people. And then the third position is Dr. Minow's, to acknowledge the fact that you are a victim, but refuse to accept the assumption that the role is inevitable. And it's a very dynamic position in which you can distinguish between the role of the victim and the objective experience that is making you a victim. See how she's making a distinction between sort of a self-definition and the actual material circumstances that may render you some rather helpless, but Dr. Minow won't let that stop him. He realizes that it's well nigh unto impossible to challenge the dictator, but he still has to do what lies within his power to do, even in this case, facing death for it. And the last position, the fourth stage, is to be a creative non-victim. But Atwood maintains that you really can't achieve this position until the entire society's position is changed, that that's a total shift in the social situation. She's not trying to blame the victim for getting themselves in these circumstances, but I think it's important to note the power of claiming what lies within our power to do. And I keep using that phrase because I love the story in Mark where the woman comes to anoint Jesus before his crucifixion, and the disciples get very upset at this woman wasting her money on this oil. And that's where he says, well, the poor you'll always have among you, but I'll, you're not going to have me. And he blesses her and says, in memory of her, we'll always know that she did what lay within her power to do. It was a seemingly futile gesture, and yet she did what lay within her power to do. Can you recall instances where you made what seemed like futile gestures, but for what you could give in the situation?
happens frequently. That's kind of my whole philosophy. I just said, I can't take care of it all. I just have to do what I can do.
What sorts of things? Situation?
I'm very concerned about abuse of pets and overpopulation of pets, and I realize I can't adopt every homeless pet on the street, so I do what I can do.
I'm
giving money or making certain that people know to have their pets spayed or neutered, and and try to contribute locally to the food bank, so I know that I'm trying to take care of the global situation locally. Environmental protection. I can't take care of all of it. I can't take care of the rainforests that aren't in my backyard, but I do try to take care of the environment that I can.
How does that leave you feeling? Do you feel powerless to affect change, or
I hope that ultimately everyone else that feels as powerless as I do does as little as I do, so I just have to hope that all of the pieces add up to something.
So your hope is that little pieces add up to something.
Because I refuse to let myself just get bogged down with the big picture all the time, because then you just spend all of your time stewing about it instead of doing anything. So just do what you can do.
Yeah, that's a very hopeful model. Does other people have situations where they may have made a gesture?
I think I'm involved with Habitat. And I think Habitat, in a way, is a gesture, but then it has that hopefulness of that she's talking about, because you definitely are making a concrete difference. And it also is amazing how much is happening. 10,000 houses will be built this year. And then even bigger is the people who are involved in doing that. The bigger goal is to link people who consider themselves of means with people who consider themselves more powerless. And so what you're doing is building bridges of understanding, getting over walls. It's the same thing that, Millard Fuller says his goal is to eliminate poverty housing from the face of the earth. That's what he says. So there's this big global picture, but I think people that work within the system know very well that the likelihood of that happening is not too likely, but it's certainly amazing what's happened in 18 years to 10,000 houses a year.
Still has to be done one house at a time.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's a wonderful example of an ethic of risk, where you set this global vision for the way, the kingdom is the way it should be, and then you just do the little piece by piece.
Yeah. And in a smaller community, it really is that way. We've done one house a year until this year. Now, while I'm gone, two houses are being started. While one is still in process, there actually will be three going at once for the first time. So it is sort of this building on something. I'm just thinking it really is. It's an empowering. So I suppose that's important. What helps sometimes with certain process things where you go is if there's an empowerment. If there's reinforcement, so there's an empowerment within the process you
helped into. Right. And I think it's empowerment all the way around. The people who seem to be benefiting directly or receive that house. But
They
buy the house through sweat equity.
And money.
And money.
So they also are contributing. And their money builds other people's houses.
Right, so then they're giving to others
giving to others. They aren't just receivers.
But also in the process, those who already have homes and maybe the privileged ones here, we're learning that we don't have to be victims of a society that can't house its people. So in that way, we've also succumbed to being victims, but rise above that in our own power to feel ourselves in a different way.
Just go back to what you said about hoping the little pieces add up to something. I think that just suggests a need for organizations and more of a political, intentional things to be sure that hope is different from optimism. Hope is something I invest myself into. And then I think the other thing is something Rosemary Ruther said someplace, I can't remember where I read it, where I said that the kingdom or the eschaton is like house cleaning. You know, you never are ever going to get the house completely clean. And so if you set out to do that, and as a person who spends a lot of time house husbanding, I've learned that, is that it's never really fully going to happen. And so don't set your sights that you're going to bring the kingdom to earth, because you can't even get your house clean.
I deferred telling you what happens at the end of the book, and so maybe as we're coming to the close, maybe I should let you know that in the process of, while they're in prison, in this tiny cell together with inadequate food or clothing, and Laura is selling her sexual favors for things like chewing gum from the guards, Laura gets beaten very badly by the guards, and Rennie, who up to the very last moment really can't quite grasp the situation that she's in, finally when she sees Laura beaten, this is her response to it. Very carefully, this is important, she turns Laura over. Her body is limp and thick, a dead weight, dead end. She hauls Laura over to the driest corner of the room and sits with her, pulling Laura's head and shoulders onto her lap. She moves the sticky hair away from the face, which isn't a face anymore. It's a bruise. Blood is still oozing from the cuts. There's one on the forehead and another across the cheek. The mouth looks like a piece of fruit that's been run over by a car. Pulp. Rennie wants to throw up. It's no one she recognizes. She has no connection with this. There's nothing she can do. It's the face of a stranger, someone without a name. The word Laura has come unhooked and is hovering in the air apart from this ruined mess. There's nothing she can even wipe this face off with. All the cloth in the room is filthy, septic, except her hands. She could lick this face, clean it off with her tongue. That would be the best. That's what animals did. That's what you were supposed to do when you cut your finger. Put it in your mouth. Clean germs, her mother's grandmother said. If you don't have water, she can't do it. It will have to do. It's the face of Laura, after all. There's no such thing as a faceless stranger. Every face is someone's. It has a name. She's holding Laura's left hand between both of her own, perfectly still, nothing is moving, and yet she knows she is pulling on the hand as hard as she can. There's an invisible hole in the air. Laura is on the other side of it, and she has to pull her through. She's gritting her teeth with the effort. She can hear herself moaning. It must be her own voice. This is a gift. This is the hardest thing she's ever done. She holds the hand perfectly still with all her strength. Surely, if she can only try hard enough, something will move and live again. Something will get born. Laura, she says. The name descends and enters the body. There's something, a movement, isn't there? Oh, God, says Laura. Or was that real? She's afraid to put her head down to the heart. She's afraid she will not be able to hear. Someone asked if there were a resurrection in Margaret Atwood, and that's about as close as we get to it. Mm-hmm. This is a hard one, but I recommend it to you and any of her other books. A couple of them have been mentioned, Cat's Eye, Handmaid's Tale, Surfacing.
That last room, I think you read Isabel Allende's book, The House of Spirit.
I'm just reading it now. Another great book. Well, thank you all very much for coming. I appreciate your comments. Sarah, thank you for reading.
Oh, you're welcome.
I know, just sort of putting you on.
Oh, it's there, totally.
Thanks.
Well, I think the women and children who need to go to a soup kitchen, soup kitchens are not all that
safe.
Yeah. And so we have this one, but we are having trouble getting the word out, and it just seems like we have such a small attendance, and it's just discouraging to.
How often do you do this?
Twice a week.
Yeah.
And it's all volunteer. We have one woman who, God bless her soul, comes in and cooks.
Every,
twice a week.
Yeah. How long has it been going?
I think it started about in 88 and then it stopped. And then we started it about 3 years ago again. But it's, it just seems like we're just getting such a, putting out all this effort, particularly this gal that's doing all that cooking, and we're just not reaching that many people or helping.